There's many things I could have talked about today. I just came out with an article recently with co-author Richard Vincenz looking at sort of Tibetan representation and preferential practices in public employment, which is a key issue for a lot of young Tibetans now coming out of the universities more and more in the Tibetan areas. But I asked Tashi what I should present, and then she said, well, can you make a connection between the Tibetan economy and U.S.-China trade relations, you know? So it's going to be a slightly different presentation than other presentations I could give. A lot of my work, as she was saying, is dealing with poverty, inequality, a lot of labor transitions happening, livelihood transitions happening in the Tibetan areas, which I studied a lot during my field work, and then now I look at more from a macro statistical perspective, just because, well, for politics and young children, it's hard for me to find time to continue my field work in Tibetan areas for the moment. I do intend to go back. So I accepted the challenge to make a connection between basically more macro, so this will be a more economic presentation. It'll be more dealing with some of the macroeconomic themes that I explore in some of my research. I'm always trying to tie the macro, often even financial dynamics, with more micro level socioeconomic changes and also political economy dynamics in my work. So this is drawing more from this macro side, which I've been writing about recently, and making a connection basically between the state-led development strategies in Western China, which anyone working in Tibet is aware of, these dramatic, extremely rapid changes happening in Tibet, which are being driven through massive amounts of subsidies and infrastructure construction and investment and so on, with the broader dynamics of global imbalances between the US and China, and what role that might play, and what role might it play in the future in terms of how could it or not impact Tibetan areas and the types of strategies that Beijing is following in Tibetan areas. So that's what I'll try and basically lead you through in this presentation. And if you have any questions, I don't mind if you interrupt me in the middle of the presentation, just because sometimes I'll from now on there will not be, until the end, there will be one picture at the end which you'll probably be relieved to see it, but in between now and that final picture, the rest will just be graphs and data. And those of you who have seen me give presentations before will know that I like to show lots of graphs. So, but just as a primer into that, the Tibetan areas in particular, well, when we talk about, maybe the first slide I should have shown should have been a map for those of you who, I think, a large number of you know what we're referring to when we talk about Tibet. When I refer to Tibet, like Tashila, I've referred to the entire Tibetan areas, which are recognized by the Chinese government itself as autonomous areas. So there's no controversy calling them Tibet in that sense. They're Tibetan autonomous areas. And half of them exist in the Tibet autonomous region, and the other half are outside the Tibetan autonomous region, absorbed into Qinghai, Sichuan, Gansu, and Yunnan. But when we look at the more macroeconomic dynamics, I'm always forced to basically look at the Tibet Autonomous Region, TAR, or Xizang, or Pudong Gyeongdong, because that's the only region where we can isolate an entirely Tibetan experience. Because if we look at Qinghai, when we look at the macro data for Qinghai, or the labor market statistics for Qinghai, or the household income statistics for Qinghai, it's expressing, even though 97.2% of the land mass of Qinghai is Tibetan areas recognized by the government, the 2.8% of land mass contains two-thirds of the population and probably more than two-thirds of the economic activity. So, like around Xining, basically, the city of Xining. So it's trickier to analyze these types of dynamics in a province like Qinghai, even though I would love to, but you would need to deal with county and prefecture level data, which some of which is available, not very reliable, and some isn't. Whereas when you're dealing with the more reliable sources of data, then you have to kind of deal at a provincial level. But I think nonetheless, more and more, especially when I was first starting to work on this stuff, say 20 years back, there was a very strong difference, I think, between TAR and the other Tibetan areas. And since the other Tibetan areas were very much neglected still, whereas the TAR was receiving a huge amount of funding from the mid-90s onwards, I think that situation has changed substantially in the sense that a lot more attention is also being given to the other Tibetan areas now by the government, various levels of government, and they have similar types of characteristics, although less exaggerated than what we see in the TAR. The TAR, of course, has the whole military aspect of the border region, which is now sensitive with India. So I think a lot of it probably has to also, you have to bring in that lens to understand what's going on. But just to give you the perspective of how fast the economy has changed, I was just looking at some of the most recent data. And if you take it from, say, 1990 to the present, so to the latest data, so say 2016, so a space of 16 years, the GDP per capita of the TAR has increased by more than 10 times, right, in real terms. So this is an incredibly rapid pace of change, like perhaps, would be the envy of most developing countries, right? And that's also, a lot of that is not being captured by households. So there's a huge discrepancy between GDP per capita and household incomes. But nonetheless, household incomes have also been increasing rapidly. Not as rapidly, but there's been a huge pace of change. Unlike elsewhere in China, where a lot of these changes are being driven by industrialization, are being driven by productive changes in the society and economy, in the TAR, at least, the changes are almost entirely being driven by government subsidies, in a sense, and government spending. I've just updated this data to 2016, which is the latest data that I have available. As soon as the next yearbook comes out, we'll be able to update it to 2017. But this is government, local government expenditure. So this is the province, the spending of the province, which includes subsidies from Beijing as a percentage of that province's GDP, so what we call gross regional product as opposed to gross, it's like gross domestic product, GDP, right? And what we see is this, I think the brief we produced for you, we reached this point here. So there was a peak, and then it slightly subsided, and then again since 2014, it continued increasing. And it's reached, I think, it's 136 or 138 is what I said today, 138% of GDP. So, I mean, even how do we even conceive that? How do we understand that? When government spending is 100, I mean, it's not government debt. You know, we talk about debt levels with respect to GDP. This is the annual expenditure of the government being almost 1.5 times the actual GDP of the province. And the thing about TAR, of course, and this is what I was saying before, is that if we go back into the history of regional development, Western regional development in China, what happened is up until about the mid-90s, the Western regions were basically stagnating and languishing during the early reform period when redistributive transfers collapsed in China, as you had enterprise reform and also fiscal reform, which allowed rich coastal provinces and firms in those rich coastal provinces to retain their profits and their taxes. And it caused basically a collapse of the redistributed fiscal system that had been operating throughout the Maoist period and into the 80s and 90s. That was propping up and supporting these Western economies. And what happened from the mid-90s onwards is the government then started implementing, with the 9th 5-year plan, prioritizing Western development, and they started increasing subsidies to the West. And then that accelerated even further in 2000 with the Western, what is often called the Western Development Strategy, or the Shibudai Kaifa, which is probably better translated as the Open the West campaign. And that's essentially what you're seeing going on here. And as I was saying, the levels of in the other Western provinces, you had the spending was at much lower levels and was sort of stagnant, and then started slowly rising. from the late 90s onwards, and then you have a similar, the blue line is Qinghai province. So you have a similar trend, but much more exaggerated in the Tibetan Autonomous Region. The key difference, of course, in the Tibetan Autonomous Region is that it's heavily, well, this is, the government deficit is not exactly the same as subsidies. Because essentially in the fiscal system in China, what happens is, like here, say if you're living in New York, part of your taxes goes to the federal government, part of your taxes goes to the state government, right? And then part of the federal taxes are then transferred back to the state, presumably. Well, it's essentially what happens in China. So when you have a deficit, that deficit is covered by Beijing transferring money to the local government, but part of that transfer is from taxes raised locally by the central government. And part of that transfer to the local province is subsidies, direct subsidies. So within this you have both. So this isn't a direct measure of subsidies, it's part subsidies and part just the transfer of revenue back to the local government, right? But what you have here is that this measure, nonetheless, in the TAR has always been extremely high. Throughout the TAR was special, whereas what you had in this early period in the 80s and 90s is this collapse of the redistributive system, where basically the amount of money that Beijing was transferring to these provinces was reduced to almost zero, and as a result, they weren't able to run deficits, right? And this was the period when these provinces were essentially in recession or stagnating or very volatile conditions. And then you had the tax reform in 1994, and this is the tax reform in 1994, when suddenly the central government regained control of a large proportion of the fiscal revenue being generated from the provinces at that point, which allowed them to then start financing Western development strategies, right? The TAR was entirely different, and I mean, I think the obvious explanation for that is because it's a militarily strategic area, so it always received a special priority, and it was insulated from these dynamics happening in the other Western provinces, right? But of course, the challenge here is to understand how much of what's going on here that is subsidies versus how much is just the central local dynamic, and so this is again taking this. So out of here, you have the expenditure. Out of the expenditure, a large proportion of this, in the case of the TAR, 90% of this is deficit spending from the local government perspective, and that amount is so. Previously, we saw expenditure was about 138% of GDP. The deficit is about 125% of GDP. So this is the highest it's ever been in the entire history of the PRC. So incredibly high levels of deficit spend, not just expenditure, but deficit expenditure. And out of that, again, I don't have the updated data yet, but at least up until 2014, so you can see here, in 2014 was right here. In 2014, the level of, I calculated the level of direct subsidy to have reached about 110% of GDP, peaking at around 115% in 2012. That since then would have increased, and I suspect would be close to about 120% based on what we're looking at. So again, the economy is just being, you have this massive inundation of fiscal resources coming into the province. And I mean, the question is not why, how it grew, but why didn't it grow even faster than it did, in a sense, right? And also what this has been creating is an economy, like you could see in a lot of developing countries where they're very aid dependent, a very polarized economy, where a lot of this funding is going into urban areas, going into enclave type construction projects and so on, and it's creating pockets of affluence to those who have access to the money, but without really transforming the rest of the more agrarian economy. And hence you have quite a high degree of inequality and polarization being generated by this type of economic model. The other aspect of that's driving the growth in the Tibetan areas isn't just the fiscal spending, but it's also investment. And a lot of the investment is being subsidized by the fiscal spending, although we used to be able to calculate that, but then around the mid-2000s, they changed the way of reporting the data, and you can't calculate that anymore. So we do know that a lot of the investment is being subsidized. We don't know to what degree. And again, it's actually, when we look at these figures, these are even more exaggerated now than the subsidy figures. Before, we used to focus on the subsidies, and then investment was high, but suddenly, since 2012, investment has apparently gone through the roof and is now reaching 140% of GDP in the case of both Tier and Qinghai. And there's a lot of data reporting problems with the investment data. So in some cases, we could say that maybe this is exaggerated, it's not the actual investment and so on. But we are looking at these extremely high levels of investment, right? So when you would take subsidized investments and subsidized government expenditures and bring those together, you'd be looking at well over probably 150% of GDP, just in terms of subsidies from Beijing either. Because what Beijing would do, for instance, is they either give a subsidy to the government of TAR, or else they give a subsidy, say a subsidized contract to China Railway. Right, so that money would never go to the TAR government, but it would go to China Railway in Beijing, which then would build railways in TAR. So it would still be subsidized spending, but via a construction contract and not via the government's budget. Yeah?
But those state enterprises then that you're talking about, the investment?
In the TAR, the investment is dominated by state. About 75 to 80% of investment is through state enterprises, yeah. Or public enterprises. Whereas in other provinces, like Qinghai, it would be more like the rest of China, where it would be more than half non-state, essentially. So I mean, when I was writing these earlier books, I was dealing with data just up to this point, and the dramatic change that's been. This is obviously a situation that everyone's talking about now in China, because a lot of this has also been, especially outside the TAR and the other Western provinces, we see this, because if any of you travel in China or travel even in Tibetan areas, just since the 2008 financial crisis, it's incredible how towns all over the place have just been transforming. Where, in Rebkong, last time I was there, the tallest building was maybe 5 or 6 stories, and now there's 20, 30 odd or more tall apartment blocks of 20, I don't know how many stories, right? And you were telling me how in Lhasa the same thing. And so every small county town throughout the country is having these construction booms, right? The question is whether it's actually productive or is it just real estate construction, to what degree it's sustainable. A lot of it's local governments using local government investment vehicles, which is a way to get around the fact that local governments can't borrow. So they use the local investment deals, which are still state-owned, to then borrow from banks. So, there's a whole bunch of compounded debt problems related to all this and so on that could potentially be a major financial mess in the future, which a lot of people speculated on. But that's essentially what's been driving a lot of this, I'm not even sure what to call this. How do you even conceptualize what this is, basically, right? In terms of, and how much of is it real and how much of is it other things. Also, there's a simple way to, one of the most obvious ways to explain this, you could call it a form of inefficiency, but it's this extremely, high level of subsidized spending and investment to GDP, which simply doesn't make sense. One way of explaining it is because it's at the same time it's allowing for a type of development strategy that's very import intensive, right? Which is what you're seeing here, because you can actually, if you measure the trade balances of the provinces in the midst of this subsidy boom and this subsidized investment boom are going into these massive trade deficits with the rest of the world, not with the rest of China, but with the rest of the world. For instance, in the case of Qinghai, these have dropped below 100% of GDP. So Qinghai is net importing from the rest of the world more than the total of its GDP. Right? In the TAR, it's been stabilizing around 80%. In other provinces, it's a bit less so, but these are also larger provinces. So, when you hit the Yunnan hitting negative 60% of GDP, it's huge, right? We're talking about billions of dollars worth of imports. And so what this means is that when you have the previous slide of the subsidized investment or the subsidized government financing going into this, the imports would be subtracted from your GDP measures, but it's not subtracted from your government spending or your subsidy measures. So the subsidies look very large, but then they're basically leaving the province to their imports, right? And so they don't have any impact on GDP besides the leftover effect of what they have on the infrastructure that's built or something like that. Obviously, what this would represent would be things like the railroad construction, because the railroads would be based on a lot of high-tech inputs from abroad, or hiring engineers from abroad, or different things like that. Obviously in mining and high-tech mining, high-tech aluminum and steel production, which you have a lot of in Qinghai, for instance, a lot of these different things could actually be very import intensive, right? You also have this similar situation with the rest of China, but we can't measure it because we don't know what the trade flows are between provinces in China. It's very difficult to record. But effectively, a province like the TAR that doesn't really produce much besides, you know, pastoral products and farming products, and maybe some electricity, but besides that, maybe some beer, maybe a few other things, some services like, you know, good singers who keep winning the Voice of China competitions and things like that. But besides that, they don't produce a lot to be able to buy all of the goods that they're consuming from the rest of China. And in particular, as the population becomes more and more urban, and they're less rooted in an agrarian economy, and their consumption is more and more based on industrial goods and so on coming from other parts of China, the more that actually the TAR parallel to this would also be having a similar type of trade deficit, if not deeper, with other Chinese provinces, in particular Sichuan, right? Which would be another explanation for a lot of subsidies coming in are quite simply financing consumption of goods from the rest of China, and then leaves the province pretty much right away. So again, it shows up in the subsidies, but in that case, it would also show up in the GDP, but effectively, if we take it out of the GDP measure, the GDP would be much smaller than it actually is. So it's subsidies financing consumption, and then the GDP is reflecting that consumption, you can imagine the type of economy it's basically creating in these regions, right? And it's not just the TAR, it's also Qinghai in that sense, right? It's also other Western provinces. And this also, I think, draws a connection. This is where I would start to make the connection to the global imbalances story. Because what is going on here, I think, for me as a development economist, particularly a structural development economist from that tradition, what I find very interesting here as well is that China is a developmental state, I mean, as far as I'm concerned. It's following a path, perhaps not exactly the same as Korea and Taiwan and Japan and so on, but it's similarly inspired. It's trying to industrialize. It's trying to catch up with the advanced industrial countries. It's still very far behind, something that if you listen to your politicians in the city, you would think that they're right up neck and neck with the US, but they're actually quite far behind, quite subordinated in the technological sort of hierarchy of production. But what we see typically in historical cases of what we call late development in development studies is that the process of industrialization, intensive industrialization, is typically very import intensive, and it's very import dependent. So for instance, as Korea, everyone always thinks that Korea was this export success story, but Korea actually, for about 30-year period, as it was industrializing very rapidly, went through these very deep trade deficits. Because even as it was moving into manufacturing exports and things like that, it was importing more than it was exporting, even if it was exporting very successfully. So the process of industrialization, typically, if unconstrained, if it has the financial resources to be able to follow that path, typically generates deep trade deficits, which is something that the World Bank and the IMF don't like. So they prefer to constrain the deficits, which effectively has the result of constraining their industrialization, right? Now, in the case of Korea and Taiwan, they had a huge amount of U.S. aid, Japanese aid, preferential loans that were financing this project, which most other developing countries never had. In the case of China, China hasn't had much access to a lot of international finance to finance this type of strategy. And what I find, this is something I've been attempting to work on more, is what you see going on here is that we have, see, China, the national economy is this line here. It's the surpluses that we're all talking about, right? These surpluses are generated by about five or six or seven coastal provinces in China. So basically, you have all of the huge export surplus that China is famous for is a coastal driven phenomenon, right? And it's financing the country's ability to follow actually fairly classic types of industrialization strategies in the interior areas, right? And so what we see is as the country's, you know, generating these very large surpluses here, and then reinvigorating redistributive strategies with the Western provinces, all these Western provinces are going through these intensive processes of industrial restructuring, which is essentially what's going on. And part of that industrial restructuring is very imports intensive, right? So you see all of these provinces as the financial constraints of regional redistribution are being sort of lifted, and as the country is generating these huge surpluses with the US and so on, it then allows it to follow a fairly classical pattern of industrialization in its interior and western provinces, right? This doesn't have much to do with the Tibetan areas, because there's not any really significant industrialization in the Tibetan areas. But I think it's an important perspective to take on what exactly the Western development strategies are being used for, because I think us from Tibet studies, we were discussing this the other day, we tend to have a Tibeto-centric view of the Western development strategy. We all think it's about maintaining stability in the Tibetan areas and keeping the Tibetans quiet and having a lot to do with ethnic relations. Whereas I think the bulk of the Western development financing in China has not been about that. It's been about industrial policy, about trying to basically restructure the industrial base of Chengdu, Lanzhou, Xining, Urumqi, Xi'an, and a few other cities that were, in the Maoist period, important industrial centers that had a lot of accumulated industrial knowledge and expertise and infrastructure. Restructuring that, an intensive restructuring of that to create these industrial centers around Chengdu and Lanzhou and Xining, which is what we have been seeing, over the last 20 years. We're in Xining, for instance, they've developed quite advanced aluminum production, steel production. It's horrible for the pollution, you know, that's when you go to Xining. But it's not even because of the availability of natural resources in Qinghai, it's because of the availability of electricity that they've strategically located those industries in that area. That's where the effect then starts to encroach on Tibetan areas, because of these hydroelectric projects are in Tibetan areas, in Qinghai. And also what's interesting about that is that it's created, I was saying earlier that what's going on in TAR is quite similar to dynamics happening in Tibetan areas outside of the TAR, but with the qualification that at a provincial level, what's happening in the TAR is very different from, say, Qinghai or Sichuan and Gansu. Because what we've seen, and I think Qinghai, what I would like to call the Qinghai model, is completely like the opposite of the TAR model in that sense. Whereas what you find here, if I point to this one, this is the TAR. So in the process of, this is the structure of the economy in terms of the GDP value added. So it's not about where the labor is, it's about where the value is, right? And so what's happened in this process of rapid development in Tibet, of course, is the typical, the shrinking of agriculture, of farming and herding as a proportion of GDP, and then a ballooning of the tertiary sector, which is dominated by the government. And then you have, unlike, I think this is unique in China, industry, which is mining and manufacturing, has basically been at a very low level and not really increasing throughout. It's increasing in value terms, but it's not increasing as a share of the economy. So despite everyone thinking that China's in TAR for mining purposes and so on, you don't really see that in the data in that sense, right? And instead, most of the growth of the secondary sector is due to construction. So what you see